Hi, I'm Ashir Miller.
I'm Rob Dietz.
And I'm Jason Bradford. You're listening to Crazy Town, where Climate Armageddon gets interrupted for breaking news about the Kardashians.
Hey, Rob and Jason.
It's good to see you.
Yeah, it's nice to talk to you virtually with Zoom.
Yeah.
Glad I'm not there to have you cough in my face, Jason.
My studio is, the recording studio is lonely.
Yeah, and the equipment's not being used. We're doing this kind of old school, janky kind of microphone setup, yeah?
Yeah, but still nice to be here with you guys, recording, trying to make the world a better place, I guess. Is that what we're doing?
Well, I wanted to actually, I asked for us to get together like this because I wanted to, everyone's having a tough time right now, and I thought it'd be useful for me. I read a story recently, and I thought it'd be useful for me to share is what I read, because I thought it might be helpful for you guys as well.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, let's hear it.
Insightful, I'm sure. Let's go.
Yeah, it's insightful. Okay, so here we go. Once upon a time, there were three bears who lived in a house in the forest.
What the hell?
There was a great big father bear, a middle-sized mother bear, and a tiny baby bear.
Baby bear!
I'll play the mother.
One morning, their breakfast porridge was too hot to eat, so they decided to go for a walk in the forest. And while they were out, a little girl called Goldilocks came through the trees and found their house.
Goldilocks!
She knocked on the door, and there was no answer, so she pushed it open and went inside. In front of her was a table with three chairs, one large chair, one middle-sized chair, one small chair. And on the table were three bowls of porridge, one large bowl, one middle-sized bowl, and one small bowl.
How long do we let them continue this story? That's what I'm wondering.
I know how it ends.
Do you? Oh, okay. Well, so I was thinking about this story for a good reason, actually.
Lay it on us. Come on, let's hear the reason.
And that's because, thinking about this, here we're recording this in, week whatever of the coronavirus pandemic. Not everybody, but most of us are under shelter in place orders, locked down, kind of doing quarantine at home. The economy has been hemorrhaging terribly. I haven't looked at the market today, but what did we get? 3.3 million unemployment filings in 1 week last week. So it's just kind of out of control. And I was just thinking about, this is one of those crises that is like, there is no right solution, right? So like, Goldilocks is her finding just the right size chair, the right temperature porridge, the right size bed. I don't know that there's a right sized solution to what we find ourselves in right now. Because sort of which is the too hot and which is the too cold approach. But, the approach of basically saying, we're just going to ride this thing out, get herd immunity, everyone's going to get sick, and we're just going to go about our business. That's kind of like too hot, right? And if we shut everything down and lock people up, it's kind of like too cold. And both of those are just almost inconceivable.
Yeah, you almost wish it was a false choice. You remember like when you're raising kids and you say, okay, we can go eat lunch now, or we can eat lunch in 2 minutes. You give them this false choice, right?
Right,
Of which one they're going to pick.
My wife does that with me still every day.
You almost wish that with coronavirus, it was a false choice. Like you could find the Goldilocks just right solution. But what you're saying is maybe that doesn't exist right now.
I don't think it does. I mean, it's really, Trump got a lot of heat for basically saying we can't let the solution be worse than the problem. We can't let the cure be worse than the disease. In this case, and we had, what was it, Lieutenant Governor of like Texas was basically saying like, hey, you old people, you had a good life, take one for the team. We got to get back to work.
The kill grandma platform for running for re-election there.
Yeah. I'm putting aside, how a lot of this kind of Tea Party rhetoric where they're talking about Obamacare, they're like these death panels for grandma. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
Now apparently we don't even need a panel.
For the economy. No, yeah.
So, we can rip on those approaches trying to think about reopening the economy, but seeing the damage that shutting things down is doing, it's a real thing and there's a real consequence to that. But the idea of like saying, okay, well, that's just too high a price to bear. asking people to effectively sacrifice. You know,
there's nothing but tough choices ahead of us. Nothing but tough, bad, or worse choices.
Yeah. I don't think there is a right solution in this case.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that we'll definitely be muddling through and trying to figure out what the response to the crisis is. But when you bring up Goldilocks, it brings to mind to me a different, kind of a different path that I've been thinking about this. And that's around the just right size of a crisis. And I guess I want to be really careful about how I talk about this, because I don't want to somehow minimize the suffering and loss and death and just struggles that people have with coronavirus. But we've talked about a lot to get the sort of changes that we've been asking for in this podcast, changes around making an economy that fits within the ecological capacity of the planet, getting off of fossil fuels so that we're not risking climate change, figuring out how to have human society that lives in more in harmony with the rest of the species that share the planet with us, stuff like that. We've said, you know, we know the problems, and yet society is not doing what's necessary. And so we've often hit on this idea that you need a crisis to kind of give us that wake-up call to push us to actually make the changes.
And, yeah, it's the shock doctrine, right? I mean,
yeah.
I don't know if we've talked about that before on the podcast, but
I'm sure we have.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, Naomi Klein sort of, you know, to do a quick take on it, Naomi Klein sort of popularized that concept, basically taking a quote from Milton Friedman, who was this neoliberal economist, sort of guru of that school of thought. He was basically saying that it's only in crises where change really happens. And it's in those moments of crises that people turn to alternative ideas. So he was advocating for people in their camp to develop these alternatives so that when what is currently politically totally untenable, right, when a crisis hits, it can become politically inevitable, you know? And I think we're even seeing that right now in this crisis, in the sense of like, things like universal basic income, which were marginal ideas. I don't know if we'll have that, but that's definitely on the table now.
Yeah, we're inching towards it, right?
Can I just take a moment of, I don't know that I can call it gratitude, but to say how often the three of us mention Milton Friedman. Like, that guy, he's like the opposite kind of economist that we would support, and yet he came up with this great idea and this quote about crisis. We keep bringing up this guy. It's amazing.
Well, the shock doctrine is an agnostic thing. I mean, it could be used for good or it could be used for evil. We've seen it being used for evil. In some ways, I think a lot about, you know, what's happening, you know, with all these local businesses being shut down and are desperate. You know, we have that in Corvallis.
Yeah.
In an effort of people trying to shore up our local businesses. You know who's making out like a bandit right now?
Amazon
or Walmart. Yeah, they're both hiring like 100,000 new employees. And so they're taking advantage of this crisis. They may be saying that they're taking advantage of this crisis to help meet a need right now. Yeah. And maybe they're doing that. But the idea that they're, when, you know, we quote unquote recover, they're going to be like, okay, yeah, we're just going to go back to kind of
I'm sure not
offering these things anymore.
They will gladly give up any market share that they've taken.
Oh, absolutely.
Well, are there examples in the past where we thought this is because you and I, we've all been banging our head against the wall saying, please change, everybody. Will you please listen to all of this information and make a nice, planned, sort of steady, easy kind of shift, you know, into the
you
better...
sound like Baby Bear right now.
Yeah, okay, yeah, no, I'm supposed to be Mama Bear.
Well, that is how we all sound when we're making our pleas.
Hey, right. Hey, everybody, can you please do what we're asking you?
Maybe. For the first time, I'm realizing why we haven't been completely successful.
We have to speak like with the voice of God instead or something. I don't know.
Papa Bear? Yeah.
Papa Bear. Yeah. But you know, but we've been saying this, preferably we do this in a rational way. But then in the back of our heads, we're going, that's probably not going to work. We need a crisis. Have there been moments that anyone can think of in the recent past where we thought, this could be it?
Like you're saying, has there been a crisis that we've experienced that that we thought would change things, would get us
right
off fossil fuel?
Absolutely. For us at PCI, at the end of 2008 was a pretty crazy year because we had oil prices shoot up to $147 a barrel, right? Record highs. People were, you know, we're getting calls from major media outlets talking to us about peak oil at the time. And then we hit this huge financial market correction, beyond a market correction. The market tanks, the financial system is collapsing. We've got massive interventions by the government. We have an election going on. Barack Obama is elected. It felt like that moment was like, as we were entering into the Great Recession, for us, it felt like, yeah, maybe this does change everything. You know?
I thought the financial system was not going to recover nearly so well, that they would never be able to reinflate all these assets.
Right.
You know, like we would learn our lesson. And it's like, no, they just made a bigger bubble than
we've
they
had the
ever
longest
did.
Period of growth, right? Yeah. Of growth in the market. That didn't turn out, but if we're thinking about like, so the Goldilocks thing, Rob, you're talking about Goldilocks in the context of,
yeah, like
is there a right size crisis?
Yeah, there's like a crisis that's too small that doesn't kind of kick our ass enough to get us into a different headspace and a different behavior.
Well,
but you could think the other side too, a crisis that's so big that it kind of wipes us out.
Well, I've got a good example of a crisis that was just in our circles, you know, of a crisis that was clearly too small. And that was the Deepwater Horizon. So for folks who maybe don't remember, you know, that was a big explosion in the Gulf of Mexico of this oil rig. And it was just pouring enormous amounts of oil into the ocean. And I remember sitting in, and I'm not going to mention the group, but a very, you know, large environmental NGO was sitting in a meeting with those guys in San Francisco. And they were all about, this is the moment. This is the moment that like kind of changes everything. Everybody's aware this is the top story in the media. You know, you go on like CNN and they're showing, I don't know if you guys remember that, they're showing the underwater shots of like the stuff pouring out. And they're like, this is it. And they were scrambling to completely change all of their work. Every campaign was focused around this moment.
Like, we will wean ourselves from fossil fuels now.
We get it now. We get it now, you know.
Hell, there's even a Mark Wahlberg movie called what? Deepwater Horizon.
Right. That clearly didn't happen. We also saw that, you know, again, with the financial crash and Occupy Wall Street. I think there was a lot of, you know, buzz there, and it did have lingering, you know, sort of ongoing impact, but the financial crisis wasn't the thing that tipped.
Wasn't big enough, right?
It wasn't big enough.
Now, I've been reading these books about existential threats, like asteroids and stuff like that. And so there obviously are things that could be too big as well. It just like destroy us. And
asteroids can't destroy us. I mean, have you seen the movie Armageddon or Deep Impact? Right. The 1998 dueling asteroid stories?
That was great. Oh my God.
Those weren't documentaries?
Oh, I'm pretty sure they were.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
But I know we came very close, and this is something that still scares me, because what's happening now could spin into something like this. The Cuban Missile Crisis. We were very close to having wiped ourselves out in that time.
Yeah, I remember actually talked to my dad about that recently, just talking about how incredible this experience is that we're all going through right now with this pandemic. You know, it's kind of shut everything down, and the fear that people have, and it's sort of overnight changed everything. And he was saying the only other experience he's had in his life, I mean, he's in his mid-70s, was the Cuban Missile Crisis. Was like that. He was saying that for like 3 weeks, people were walking around thinking that at any moment we could all be dead, right?
Oh, geez.
Like it just in a flash.
I'm actually kind of amazed all three of us have gone this direction, because I've been listening to the Cold War podcast. And of course, the Cuban Missile Crisis is like the precipice moment of that podcast. And you think about what was going on during that time with Russian boats delivering nuclear missiles to Cuba, and then the U.S. basically trying to blockade that. And oddly enough, in a strange twist for today's stuff, I think John F. Kennedy, very much on purpose called it a quarantine rather than a blockade, because it had a little less bite and a little less act of war kind of feel to it to say it's a quarantine.
Yeah, we're at a stay-at-home order right now, not a quarantine.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. Well, that's amazing that all three of us were thinking about the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Well, that's because we're all, you know, we spend our time thinking about the worst-case scenario a lot, right?
Yes. Well, the good thing, of course, is that did not turn into too hot of a crisis and sort of wipe out civilization. We came super close, but that gets us to this moment with coronavirus as maybe being the right size crisis. Now, I don't want this taken out of any sort of context. You know, there's no way in hell you could say that any of us are glad to be dealing with coronavirus. We feel horrible about those who are affected. Jason, I know that your wife is kind of a frontliner here.
Sort of at this moment. She's a clinician. She's not a hospitalist. And so she doesn't work in an ICU, but she's a physician that works at county health clinics. And they've had to reorganize and do telemedicine and make sure that they do, you know, swabs in the parking lot and set aside safe zones in their clinic for patients that come in that they have to see. But I, you know, she and her staff are worried and thinking about if, you know, the hospital surge goes too far and they set up wards outside of the hospital and the county's preparing for that now, hundreds of extra beds that she, you know, and her staff would have to go and take care of people who may be, you know, in trouble and infectious. So yeah, I do worry about that. And I know other physicians and nurses at the hospital, just because, you know, being part of the connected via my wife to the medical community a little bit. Yeah. So gosh, yeah, I'm a little nervous.
So, I mean, let's just be perfectly clear about it. We don't want to be dealing with coronavirus. We're not cheering this crisis and saying, yay. I mean, we wanted some kind of orderly transition in the economy, a well-planned weaning ourselves off of fossil fuels over time. That wasn't happening. And as we've said, it's crisis when things do change.
Let me just add one point to that.
Yeah.
It's obviously we would have preferred that. And I say this from a place of relative comfort right now, but it's so clear with this crisis that it's disproportionately affecting people.
Yeah.
And I certainly would never wish that the most vulnerable among us and the ones that have, not just in terms of vulnerability to, you know, the virus itself, but the economic fallout of all this.
Yep.
Sure. Know? Yeah.
And it's totally unequal and unfair. That part of it is particularly upsetting and I think worrisome.
Oh, there's so many stories coming out now about just weird stuff. The food pantries in town are having trouble and people are stressed. I'm nervous about how this will unfold. And I'm also nervous, though, about, like, let's imagine we get through this and we somehow, like, reorganize. And are we going to go back to where we were or not, right? Are we going to be doing what we did after Deepwater Horizon or not?
Well, I mean, it's possible. And I do want to get into that. But I think we should start by looking at that idea of that notion of, is this crisis kind of right size to shift society? And I feel like there's been some evidence. Hmm. One of the things that's happened is that obviously this economic slowdown, you could even call it a calming moment when you're thinking about the effects of the economy on the environment. That's been pretty well documented that emissions are dropping, air and water quality are improving. We couldn't do that before this crisis. So that's an example. And you started talking a little bit, I think even a more important one maybe to unpack a little bit is the idea of universal basic income.
Yeah.
What an idea that was so opposed, so attacked. No way we're going to do this. And now you've got a country like Denmark is guaranteeing 75% of your salary. And even here in the US, we've got a $2 trillion aid package, some of which is direct payments to citizens.
Yeah. And I've heard talk about, like, you know, people get SNAP benefits. It's sort of like what food stamps became, SNAP. And they walk around with these cards and they can take them to buy food. And there's a way to deliver then, because people who are the poorest in our society are walking around with cards that the government can put funds into quickly. So like there's another quick way you can, at least for the people who are poorest, get them funds to get them through. And for a long time, it's been hard to get SNAP benefits to increase, right? And now there may be like, oh God, we better pile money into those.
Yeah, I mean, I think we spent a lot of time talking about some of these policies, and I don't know that we're there quite yet in terms of, you know, there's a lot of criticism that you can levy to this $2 trillion package that was put out and the single check essentially going out to households right now. I don't think we're quite there yet, but the fact that some ideas really seemed impossible before are now on the table. We may not actually take them up and implement them, but they're definitely on the table now, right? And that to your point, Rob, is a signal that this is a pretty severe crisis. It's forcing us to do things different. Just the fact that everyone's at home is incredible.
You know what I mean?
There was another one that I thought of, which is rationing. A few weeks ago, you shared a video with me and Jason on Jeff Bezos and his flight of fancy. The video was him talking about how we're facing an energy crisis. We live on a finite planet. We have this addiction to fossil fuel and blah, blah. We need to make the change. And it was sort of like, yay, go Jeff Bezos. You're talking post-carbon language.
He was totally channeling us and Al Bartlett and what have you. Yeah.
But then, of course, he makes a turn and he says, okay, we got to do something about this. He doesn't say, let's ration fossil fuels and wean ourselves off. He says, let's build space colonies and launch everybody up into orbit and we'll have a trillion people floating around in space, you know,
and he makes these, if you're listening to this, Rob is not exaggerating. He really said that.
It's fantastic.
And he'll fly you there in his space penis.
It does look like a giant penis. but this is what's amazing, guys, is that suddenly all of this stuff we've been talking about in this podcast for a year, and now we've got almost 2 years of recordings. There's a lot of podcasts that are just coming out and are about to come out of ours that we've recorded. It's front and center in people's minds. It's just amazing.
Yeah.
And so I think this is now giving us the opportunity to actually have people listen to us for once.
Yeah, maybe. Well, we better put on our baby bear voice for that to actually happen. But you're right. The whole idea of rationing, it doesn't sell well.
It's coming up.
Yeah, I know. But I'm saying it doesn't sell well. Nobody's like, yay, rationing.
Right.
Hell, compare that to hoarding.
Right, exactly.
You know, and now you've got a way better system of allocation. And we're already, this again, just getting back to the idea of what the crisis opens up. We're already seeing rationing in some areas, especially with medical gear. And that's a scary one, but trying to figure out how to take the limited set of ventilators we have and use them to save the most lives. It's sure better to have a system like that than just say, oh, the richest people get them.
To your question, Rob, this crisis, could it be the right size crisis? Putting aside the fact that we don't want to be here and we don't want loss of life and the suffering that's going to come with this. Yeah, I mean, I think there's evidence that it could be. And you know, when people say, oh, we can't do that or we can't do this around climate change or around some of the other existential threats that we face, clearly we can do anything. They're printing, you know, money, you know, like it's nothing. So that does show us that it's possible to change pretty dramatically in response to crises. I worry, though, that there's a system in place. This is what happened with the financial crisis, in a sense, you know, 2008, 2009, right? The system was breaking down, but it was still sort of in this, you know, I had this conversation with Nafiz Ahmed, which we put out on the Crazy Town feed recently, and we were talking about the life cycle, you know, the adaptive life cycle, and it goes through these phases. And one of the phases is sort of this conservation phase. And that
you're
is
talking
that
any system.
Any system. So the system in the conservation phase, it's not growing anymore, but it wants to maintain itself, right? And it has set up a lot of, you know, structures in order to try to maintain that. And that's what we had with the financial crisis, in the sense that, like, we bailed out the banks. We did all these interventions that you would have seemed unimaginable. We bailed out the auto industry. You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah, all these like, industries just conserve their spot where they were before so they could just keep going.
And the people that were advocating and pushing for this were, you know, we live in a country that's all about the free market and corporations, you know, not getting in their way or whatever. In that case, we're bailing them out. So, and that was about maintaining, conserving the system as much as possible. So I think that we're further along. We've spent a lot, you know, we've spent trillions in the meantime. You know, we've sort of, in the sense, given ourselves more rope to hang ourselves with. At the time, what was, I think China was something like less than 10% of global trade. Now they're 30% or something. You know, I mean, things have changed just in the last 12 years or so to make it even harder, in a sense, and that system to be more brittle. But there is going to be a lot of interest in trying to maintain the system. So that's in the sense of the people that are have their hands on levers of policy and decision-making. But from the standpoint of kind of general population, especially if this lasts a while and it's really painful, the psychological inclination to want to go back to normal is going to be very strong. You know,
I think that's going to be mixed. And I struggle with that myself because I'm in terms of what I'm seeing, because I think, yes, there's going to be a certain proportion of the population. It's like, get me back to where I was as fast as possible, my comfort zone. But then I'm also having conversations with people who are like my neighbor, Pam, who now is a Crazy Town listener. Pam, love you. So Pam.
I'm sorry, Pam. I'm sorry if you're listening to this.
So Pam calls me over and I go to her backyard and I stay as far away from her as I can while still talking to her nicely. And she takes me back to her pool and she goes, Jason, we don't use the pool anymore. I want to turn it into a root cellar. And she's showing me these drawings she's made up. And I'm going to have like a kitchen garden out here. What do you think? What should I do? Is that going to work? And I look at her drawings and I say, gosh, that's pretty good, Pam. I would do blah, 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 blah. She's like, you know what? I've been wanting to do stuff like this for years. I just started listening to your podcast. I'm totally with you. I've just been caught up in raising a family and make enough money to get by. But now we're going to change. We're going to do the stuff that we always knew we should be doing. And so it's interesting. I think this is going to, we're at this threshold, right? Where you're going to have, there's certain sunk costs and this sort of, you know, psychology of previous investment where people want to go back. And then there's other people who are going to want to like say, no, I really do want to make these changes. And I think that's going to be the real crux of what happens over the next couple of years is which way does society move? Which direction does it go?
Yeah. I got to say, this is, reminding me of an article that I just read from George Monbiot, who really hits that idea that you're talking about, Jason. There's going to be a huge swath of people out there that are stuck on the sunk costs. You know, we've already invested in this energy system. We've already invested in this style of living, this set of behaviors that we're used to. And therefore, we're going to hang on to that with everything that we can. And a lot of times you'll hear about that is called the fallacy of prior investment, because it's not a smart way to make decisions about what you do going forward. So to me, it's really heartening to hear about people like Pam who are taking it to heart that this is a moment of change and I can do this and my family can do this and we can really work towards building a better sort of society.
Yeah, that I want to talk about making up a concept here. The fallacy of not prior investment, but the fallacy of prior narrative or prior vision for the future. Because I do think that we're going to see a lot of people, and we already are seeing this, talking about the lessons of this for addressing the climate crisis, or talking about things like the Green New Deal. You know, here's an opportunity when we're going to go into recovery, right? There's going to, at some point, we're going to get hopefully past the triage state, right? And we're going to be thinking about how do we recover and recover the economy and address some of the issues that came up from this crisis. There are people going to be advocating for new ways of doing things. I think you will see even stronger calls for Medicare for all or things like that, you know, universal health insurance, and we'll see calls for the Green New Deal. But if we have expectations that are built on previous narratives and visions for the future, including the Green New Deal, for example, which is you know, yeah, we're going to do this transition of the economy towards a green economy. But the idea is that we're going to have a lot of well-paying jobs for people and lifting people out of poverty. And they're going to have more, you know, disposable income to spend on buying more stuff. Do you know what I mean? I think there's a fallacy in there as well that we have to watch out for.
Totally. Yeah. And I think the reality of the new world is going to break those down. And you're seeing this in agriculture too, in the food system. There's tons of interest now in like local food. And there's a lot of stuff coming out about how migrant labor forces around the world that pick fruits and vegetables can't show up. And in France, there's a call for 200,000 people to join the agricultural labor force because they can't get people coming in from Eastern Europe and North Africa. And so it's like, it's getting real. There's like a real need for people then to step up and do something meaningful.
Yeah, well, I think in terms of that stepping up, there's an article, I've been doing a lot of reading, obviously, Teen Vogue.
Okay.
Of all places.
You have a subscription to that, right?
Yeah.
Teen Vogue, yeah. Well, it has become the most pertinent periodical in the United States mainstream.
That's a bold statement.
I know. It's unbelievable. Well, you know, there's a recent article in there basically making that point. We cannot go back to what we were before because A, it was undermining the life support systems of the planet, and B, it was totally unfair. So there's a place to go if you want to get some really up-to-date info. Teen Vogue. I never thought I'd be trying to sell subscriptions. But yeah, so in terms of call to action, I think this is on theme for us because I think there's a Goldilocks way to approach it. On the one hand, you could see like, okay, we have this opportunity in crisis, so let's do it. Let's have a big collapse, you know, and you see even some environmentalists cheering that on. But I think that's pretty damn cruel and just lacking in compassion. But then on the other side, you've got what we've hit on, that there's like too cold of a response. People who are going to just cling to the past, try to hang on to what we had, fall prey to that fallacy of prior investment or fallacy of prior narrative, as you were talking about, Asher. So there's got to be a Goldilocks in there where we have the courage to enter into the kinds of changes that we need in our lives and that we need in our communities.
Yeah, I think that is critical. You know, it's not easy to change. And I think we have to be very compassionate for people who are struggling with this, right? And things are changing so fast right now. But I think you're right. You know, keeping our wits about us, being intelligent about things, talking to people and having these uncomfortable conversations, which, you know, we often is the theme of our show right at the end. Like, we need to talk about stuff that's not easy to talk about. And people are starting to do that. People are starting to talk about things and open up and share in ways that they haven't for a long time. It's ironic. You know, we have maybe physical distancing, but we are maybe socially connecting somehow in ways that are unusual for us and talking about meaningful things. So yeah. I think those need to be courageous conversations, like you're saying, Rob.
And part of the having courageous conversations is initiating conversations in the first place. It's hard to do. In some ways, it's easier to do it now because it's much more top of mind. People, I think, are going to resonate a lot more with people bringing up questions about our dependence on global supply chains and kind of the inequality that's built into our system, you know, in these other lessons. But when we're in triage mode, it's not the time to be like, hey, you know what I think? Like, this is bad, but you know what's really bad? It's climate change. You know, like, I think we have to be sensitive to that. Even things like, and it's potentially true, I've had lots of people share with me, hey, if you look at what's been happening with pollution and the reduction in pollution, there are more lives that have been saved because pollution's gone down in China than have been lost from this. That to me is a really tone deaf thing to say right now.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So there's an opening here, but you got to be diplomatic about doing it. And I think that the other thing is sort of know the timing of when to raise these larger questions. And the other thing is to practice it ourselves. So we're all going to have a tendency, hey man, I, I, I could see myself being tempted to get on a plane going to Disneyland when this is all over. Not really.
Disneyland, yeah, but come on.
But you know, trying to go out there and kind of re-experience life the way that we had it. And I'm not saying don't do any of those things ever again, but start investing now. Do things now that we're doing to get through this that create the right habits so you continue, even though the rest of the world is quote unquote trying to get back to normal.
Yeah,
that's right. Having these courageous conversations, moving ahead in a smart way, in a compassionate way, and of course, trying to find the porridge that's the right temperature. That's really critical in this time.
Well, I got to tell you, one of the things we did when we came up with our shopping list, you know, when this was early on, we're like, do we have enough stuff, was oats for oatmeal.
That was
on the list. Yeah.
But healthy eating, taking walks in nature, getting some kind of exercise, getting plenty of sleep. You know, in many ways, I think people are going to probably start developing some new habits out of sort of the anxiety and the opportunity they have. And hopefully it's a lot of those can carry on, of course.
And they all live happily ever after.
Thanks, Elmo, baby bear, whatever you are.
Okay, guys, we're gonna do something a little special, right? This is a different time, and we're redoing our show a bit. And so, this segment is called Quarantine Corner, and we're gonna do a little check-in and share some stories about how things are going with us. All right?
Sounds good. Now,
okay.
Who wants to go first?
I mean, this
I think
is
you fun. Should,
Jason. Why don't you go first?
Yeah, you go first.
Well, okay. You know, I'm really feel lucky. I've got a beautiful place to live and I can get outside and I'm, you know, I kind of feel like I'm in really good place and I feel
good
about
that. Give
people
your address.
Yeah. Try not to advertise that too much before you're in a really bad place.
You know, I live on a farm and I get outside and do gardening and stuff. And so that's pretty nice. I got nature close by and I stocked up on plenty of great food well ahead of the rush. So that's doing well. I do have some friends though that are having a little more difficulty, and so I'm trying to support them. You know, I've got this I got this buddy in LA, and he and his beautiful young wife, I mean, they're really struggling. They can only have sex with each other.
That was not where I thought you were going with this.
I should, you know, it's the swinger community down there. I mean, the big story of this is how that community is going to be really impacted by what's going on.
That's true.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. What about you?
Wow. Well, thanks for that. I don't know. I think for me in this time, there's a weird balance you're trying to find between keeping your sense of humor and not being an asshole, you know, like you can be really insensitive.
That's every day for me, man. What are you talking about?
True. All of us are struggling there. Right. But I was talking with a friend yesterday and it was something he said really, really made me laugh. And who knows, maybe I'm an asshole, but we were, a few weeks ago before the quarantine was really in place, we went out, we were getting outside and we went to the Columbia River Gorge, beautiful place to go hiking. And, you know, I figured, oh, we'll just get out there and we'll be alone or at least in our nice little zone of nature and we can be away from people. But a lot of people had the same idea, obviously. So we're hiking on this beautiful trail of waterfalls and there are other hikers out there and there's just places in the gorge where you can't really get past somebody with 6 feet of distance.
And so there's a cliff on your left and a cliff on your right, for God's sakes.
Yeah. So my friend was like
a coughing person in front of you.
You know, my friend was like, well, that brings new meaning to social distancing as you throw people off the cliff. And I was like, that's why they call it a waterfall.
Yeah.
So I was thinking about who benefits the most from this or who's kind of least impacted by this whole thing, right? And there have been jokes online about gamers, basically. You know, guys who like sit down and play a game all day long, like, oh, there's a pandemic going on? I didn't realize. But
they were playing a pandemic game, right?
Yeah, there is one, I think.
What about introverts? like for introverts, this is like a blessed relief, right? Like,
well, unless you're stuck at home with people you don't really like. You know,
I'm kind of a weird introvert. I am introverted. Yeah. And which means that I need time by myself to sort of decompress. You know, being around people can be energetically taxing for me.
Yeah.
And I'm sharing the space with my family. I've taken over our bedroom to do work in, so I have space on some level. But we, you know, we're lucky. We have a house that's relatively large, so we can kind of spread out if we need to, and we can always go outside. But there are probably other introverts. You're right. This could be the best of times and the worst of times for introverts, depending upon their situation. And the flip side for extroverts.
I'm curious, Asher, you're making me think of a new theory about introversion and Zoom. So like if you're on a Zoom conference, does that feel like you're spending energy hanging with people and then you got to go decompress? Or is it like, oh no, I was by myself?
It totally is spending energy. You guys, just spending time with you is exhausting for me. Oh,
I'm so sorry. Well, we better let him go then, huh, Rob? This is horrible for him. So. Yeah. So that was very nice being in quarantine corner with you guys for a while. And we'll check in.
2 meters apart, right? Let's be clear.
Yeah.
2 meters apart in our corner.
But we'll check in with each other the next time we do Crazy Town, okay?
All right.
And let me just put a call out for our listeners. We are inviting folks to send us comments, send us questions, especially in this time. I think that's super valuable. So we want to hear from you. So if you have any questions, any things that you're thinking about or stories you want to share about what life is like in quarantine for you, send us an email. And you can send that to crazytown@postcarbon.org.
That's crazytown@postcarbon.org.
Yeah. And if we get some good comments from folks or good questions, we'll play those on a future episode.
All right. Take care, everybody.
Yeah, take care. Be safe.